spent 30 years perhaps studying philosophy or biology or anthropology, then we need to talk from our position of strength, which is not his. And we need to address ourselves to his position of weakness. And I found that the best way to do that, and I had recent experience in Canada in teaching several classes, was to assume it. You draw their fangs because they feel you're going to argue it. And then when you don't, you're on a firm footing to begin with. Now, I'm not saying it did happen. It's a fundamental tenet of your faith that Genesis 1 is literal to minute detail, then I'm not concerned to disturb that. All I'm saying is that in talking and in evangelism, we don't need to press that point in order to be effective evangelists. Because we can talk about Genesis 1 and about evolution till our dying day and still not get to the gospel. When we talk about these things, we're presenting the gospel as we do it. And we're talking about the things that Paul speaks of in Romans 1:19, that are referred to in Ecclesiastes 3:10 or John 1:9. Which we know to be true. Yeah?
I have a question concerning a little bit of a gap there. I know that whenever I'm trying to witness and I take an issue, I never bring up the subject of evolution.
No.
But occasionally, the other person will bring up the subject of evolution. And from what I've, you know, my limited reading, what I've seen, seems that the effort is to show that, I'm not sure this is what I'm saying, but the effort, the reason they bring it up is to show that man is continually progressing. Now, perhaps you don't have to argue against evolution to show that man is
right. Yeah.
Okay. So, now, is that how you bridge the gap as far as saying, look, I'm not going to argue with you about it?
Yeah.
What exactly, why did you bring it up in the first place?
You said the evolutionists are trying to establish the fact that man is progressing, and you're saying what?
I'm saying that perhaps you don't have to argue against evolution per se to prove that man isn't progressing.
Right. That's right. We don't have to argue against evolution. If we do, it carries on forever without ever coming to any conclusion. The reason that I've mentioned it now is that we can deal with all of this without ever talking about evolution. But when we're taught this, it just puts it in its perspective. Usually we don't talk about evolution when we talk about these things over the side. But if we do talk about evolution, we don't need to alter our approach. Well, was there another question over here or comment?
Yeah. Discussion, you know, centering on the six sects on the right, I can see how you'd say that we wouldn't really have to talk about evolution. But I think you have to deal with their evolutionary assumption. That is, I think you have to deal with their assumption that man is getting better and better as time goes on. Just, you know, if you don't address this question in your presentation of the gospel, then the gospel sits at you.
Yeah, that comes under morality number 4, which deals with pain and with the sin of man, because we're talking here of the contradictions of the evolutionary philosophy. We're not talking about the contradictions of evolution. We're talking about the contradictory nature of the evolutionary philosophy, and these 6 hit most of them. There's 1 or 2 that are not there. Yup.
This may seem real illiterate, but I don't understand how, on the one hand, you can say that that scientists have yet to explain, they possibly have explained physical development, they have yet to explain the development of human nature, and you can say that on the one hand. On the other hand, you can say we don't need to prove that man's not developing. I don't see. Why do you think man isn't?
I'm not with you. I mean, man is developing.
But
morally, he's not developing.
So you're speaking just morality, that's what you're saying?
I thought that's what we were talking about then. Intellectually, men are developing.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay.
Okay. So there are six areas here that we need to find out about them and what they have to say and how these can be useful in evangelism. And basically all I've given you here are some quotations. Let's have a look at some of them. We didn't pick all of them. And before we do that, we need to be fellows and girls who do read. Because unless we're reading and finding out about things, we're not going to be good at dealing with questions. And as we read, we can begin to fit things into certain pigeonholes of knowledge. Now, that little illustration under the dotted line is one that, from memory, I took from one of Schaeffer's books. And my title for the section was Taking the Roof Off, that a man lives with his presuppositions. And in taking the roof off, we're attempting to show him that he cannot live with those presuppositions and, in fact, is not living according to those presuppositions. That the closer this line, this arrow, you'll notice the man's just a little way along it. If he was living entirely according to his presuppositions, he'd be at the end of the arrow, which almost nobody does. In fact, it's impossible, because a man is made in the image of God, and he cannot live according to the presupposition that we've stated of the uniformity of natural causes in a closed system. Now, we want to take the roof off so that a guy can see the impossibility of his position. And we want to take the roof off not only that he'll see the impossibility of his position, but he'll see that the answers can only be found in the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, there are a couple of quotations there under personality. And the question is this, that if the universe began by accident, spontaneously and impersonally, you might put down that word impersonal on the little illustration up here where it has spontaneous generation. You might put impersonal beside it or underneath it. But the assumption is that the universe began impersonally by accident. The question is, if that is so, where did personality come from? And there are a couple of quotations there and that you would need to read far beyond this. But these will show the direction that your answer would take. In the first one, both of these are from Francis Schaeffer. No one has presented an idea, let alone demonstrated it to be feasible, to explain how the impersonal beginning, plus time, plus chance, can give personality. We are distracted by a flourish of endless words. A low personality has appeared out of the hat, and so on. And if you should read books by evolutionists who try to do a thorough job in not only presenting the physical development of man, but also how human nature developed, this is true. But I haven't read very extensively, but what I've read from Huxley and Simpson, there's an endless flourish of words, but there's no answer, and they recognize that. Then the second quotation there, from Genesis in Space and Time, an impersonal beginning explains neither the form of the universe nor the personality of man. The Judeo-Christian tradition begins with the opposite answer, and it is upon this that the whole Western culture has been built. The universe had a personal beginning on the high order of Trinity, that is, before in the beginning. The personal was already there. Love and thought and communication existed prior to the creation of the heavens and the earth. So beginning with a personal God in the high order of Trinity, we can not only explain the personality of man, but we can also explain how it is that man communicates. And we can also explain the reality of love, that love is something which transcends the survival of the fittest. And the only answer can be found in creation, however that creation took place, by a personal being on the high order of Trinity. Now, we don't have time to get into that, but that would be that one direction in which dealing with a philosophical problem that you would go, that you might talk about personality and the impossibility of explaining personality. on any other basis than that of a God in the high order of Trinity.
Do you divorce the development of morality from the development of personality and all that?
No, it all happens together, but sometimes you have to separate things just to... And there are arbitrary distinctions. You have to do it just in order to come across.
Well, just for the benefit of me, would you explain how, basically like a background, but I still don't understand, if you cannot divorce the thoughts of morality from the other five, then man is progressive. And you can't single out one. You can't say, yeah, he's developing his meaning, freedom.
Well, we're not saying he's developing in any of those areas. He's regressing in personality, because in his Adamic state, man's personality and being was very different to that which it is today. He had constant communion with God. He probably... there's a certain amount of conjecture has to go into that.
But you reason?
Yeah?
State reason, you have to think we're regressing. Or do you equate the ability to reason with intellectual development?
Well, if you're talking about intellectual development, it's hard to see where Adamic man would have gone if he hadn't fallen. Probably a lot further, intellectually, because our intellect has also been affected by the fall. But nevertheless, because of the accumulation of experience, we're learning more. If Adam hadn't fallen, he would have gone further quicker. But he would still have to have learnt by experience. He'd have begun by making rather crude clay pots before he ended up with immortal masterpieces. And his mathematical reasoning would have begun with simple beginnings before...
It means it's a comparative progression.
Well, no, there's a... I guess it is in some ways. That Adam had the... Adam was put in a situation where he would develop, not in a situation where there he was with everything given to him. Eden was a growing situation. And because we're still made in the character of God and we're still sons of Adam, there is growth. The fall was absolute. That when Adam fell and sin came in, he became a sinner. And whatever form the sin should take, it was of an absolute nature. He was a sinner. And we are sinners. There's no greater sin or lesser sin. There's just sin.
But there's still development.
Not in morality.
Oh, divorcing morality from the rest, which we already decided you can't do.
Well, every one of these we have in a limited form. Our freedom has become illusory. Only in relationship to God, with Him as Lord and us as servant, do we have real freedom. But since we've divorced ourselves from God, we have a form of freedom, but it's really a different form of bondage to sin and to our passions. So we're free, but free for what? For sin and passion. It's where it's going to be plugged in. The freedom either is plugged into God, but it's still not freedom in the sense of there being no restraints or no control. It's freedom to fulfill our destiny as His sons. And that was the freedom Adam had. The freedom we have now is the freedom of, very simply, no other, of being sinners and being controlled by our passions.
So what I was looking to is kind of a pseudo-progression.
Yes. Or in meaning. Well, there's been no even apparent progression in meaning. That's... Meaning is the sore, exposed nerve of our generation. And that's the one that we talk to most of all. Oh, listen, I love talking. Yeah?
I think I understand you saying that there's a certain degree of difference between our progression intellectual in terms of just outward expressions of things that we put together, and our personality, our morality, our sort of soul character. And that is the area we're really talking about. We're talking about a tremendous lack of progression.
Well, there's material progression, that's undeniable, but of a far slower and less perfect form than would have been if Adam hadn't fallen. And it's also divorce from reality, that the material progression, what's it for?
Well,
It's going to collapse into ruins one day. But let's head through a little, and let's not spend too much time on personality, but the question is there. How could an impersonal beginning explain the personality of man? And it cannot. Sure.
According to the Bible, good does not mean that survival of the fittest is compatible with God's plan.
I don't want to speak to it because I'm not an expert. See, I don't know. I've believed different things. I've gone from one Paul to another concerning how we came to be where we are.
Well, I mean just in terms of animals.
Well, yeah, I believe that that evolution is not incompatible with the scriptures. But I don't want to answer that. You know, I believe that. But answering it would be futile. That if survival is the only basis on which morality has developed, then every decision we take would be on the basis of survival. Now, some people believe that. But if that's true, there could be no such thing as morals. There could be no right or no wrong. Any statement we make would be just the same as I itch or I don't itch, or I like this and I don't like that. But there could be no morality, there would be no such word, there'd be no concept of it, that if survival is the only thing, what leads to survival would be the basis of every decision I take. And that would be the logical conclusion of the evolutionary presupposition. But no man can live that way. Nobody can live as though love does not exist. He may say love doesn't exist, but he goes home and kisses his wife. Or he has a little baby and hugs it. And he knows that that's not just a survival instinct. And therefore love, which by its very nature is sacrificial, transcends the survival of the fittest, because many men have given their lives in a way which doesn't forward the survival of the race, but they've given their lives for principles. So, yeah?
What I don't understand is, I see it as you presented it, seems like it has to be equal. But I think that's more of what you're presenting, because I can see them both existing at the same time. I think you can easily believe that. Like I was talking to the guys over there, when people love, we love for no reason, and that's because we expect an equal return.
Okay, they could both exist, but what you have to say is that none of the other exists. That none of the that nothing exists that isn't related to survival. Well, if a lot of our love, because our fallen state is related to survival, there is still some which is not, and it's that some which cannot be accounted for.
What is the sum?
Well, it's hard to spell it out, but we know how it is, how we might... Christ dying on the cross would be a classic example. Why? Or one man giving his food to another in a prison camp so that he can live, but he'll die. Why? Okay. That's your prerogative, you see. I don't know enough about it to argue. Maybe you're right. Probably you are. But I won't get involved on a discussion on that level, because it leads nowhere. And in evangelism, that will not help you to discuss that.
I know it doesn't help evangelism, but you know, just looking at the way what John has said,
Yeah. Okay, it's another question, and we're talking about evangelism now, and I fluctuated on that one. I believe the authority of the scriptures from Genesis 1 through to the end of Revelation, but there are different forms of truth, and truth is expressed in different ways. But I no longer find it profitable to discuss it, other than with friends sometimes we go over it again, or I find another book and I read it. Personality, the value of man. You'll see there's a couple of little quotations from my book. I have a lot. There's just a couple there. This one by Jean-Paul Sartre from Communists and Peace is very interesting. All kinds of materialism leads one to treat every man, including oneself, as an object. That is, as a set of predetermined reactions, in no way different from the patterns of qualities and phenomena which constitute a table, or a chair, or a stone. Now, that's a statement by a man who is an atheist, who sees very clearly the consequences of atheism, that it leads to a complete devaluation of humanity. And then Michael Green's comment at the top, which is a very good one. It's always seemed to me utterly absurd for the atheist to profess such deep regard for the random products of a universe where chance is king. And then a little later, it never surprises me to learn that atheistic humanism is utterly ruthless in torturing and eliminating unwanted persons when it becomes the dominant philosophy in countries that have made a clean break with the Christian tradition. Then the conclusion, if as some suppose man is the outcome of a fortuitous concourse of atoms, why on earth should you not manipulate him as you please, provided it is in your power to do so with impunity? And let's not get into that, but let's look now at reason. And Darwin's horrid doubt has always fascinated me. With me, the horrid doubt always arises whether the convictions of a man's mind, which has been developed from the mind of lower animals, are of any value at all, if are of any value or at all trustworthy. That was a question Darwin asked towards the end of his life. You know, if this is true, how can the processes of a man's mind be trustworthy? The survival factor is the only one that controls what we are. And David Lack's comment, this came from the book The Unresolved Conflict. At this point, therefore, it would seem that the armies of science are in danger of destroying their own base, for the scientist must be able to trust the conclusions of his reasoning. Hence, he cannot accept the theory that man's mind has evolved wholly by natural selection. If this means, as it would appear to, that the conclusion of the mind depends ultimately on their survival value and not their truth, all scientific theories, including that of natural selection, would be untrustworthy. Or Haldane, if my mental processes are determined wholly by the motions of atoms in my brain, I've no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true, and hence I have no reason for supposing my brain to be composed of atoms. you can go on. There's some very amusing quotations from different people. C.S. Lewis, by the way, in his book on miracles, has a couple of chapters on reasoning, which are classic. And chapters 1 to 5 in his book on miracles deal with reasoning and morality. And anybody who's interested in communicating the gospel to thinking people should read the first 5 chapters of Miracles. He has such a brilliant way of communicating as well. I have several pages down in my little book here typed out from Miracles, but it would take too long to read them. One point he makes is that the total system, this system, is not supposed to be rational. It's accidental. The total system is not supposed to be rational. All thoughts, whatever, are therefore the results of irrational causes, and nothing more than that. The finest piece of scientific reasoning is caused in just the same irrational way as the thoughts a man has because a bit of bone is pressing on his brain. If we continue to apply our rule, both are equally valueless. And so on. I'd like to read it all, but there's just not time. The Freudian proves that all thoughts are merely due to complexes, except the thoughts which constitute this proof itself. The Marxist proves that all thoughts result from class conditioning, except the thought he is thinking while he says this. It is therefore always impossible to begin with any other data whatever, and from them to find out whether thought is valid. You must do exactly the opposite. You must begin by admitting the self-evidence of logical thought. We are interested in man only because his rationality is the little telltale rift in nature which shows there is something beyond or behind her. That's how he concludes this long section on reasoning. And that's down at the top of page 4. We are interested in man only because his rationality is a little telltale rift in nature which shows there is something beyond or behind her. But to learn how to use this in an evangelistic situation, you have to read extensively, make some notes, get it into your own thinking patterns and forms, so that you don't have to keep looking up quotations and you don't come across as artificial. It has to be part of your thinking pattern. And reading what other people have said is a great help towards that. Now let's look at morality and meaning. And this is page 4 now of the handout. There's much more to this than we have down here. I read a book called Evolution and Ethics by Julian Huxley, and then Evolution in Action by the same man, and The Meaning of Evolution by Gaylord Simpson, both men being atheists. And their chapters on morality are tragic. Schaefer's comment as he evaluates statements such as Huxley and Simpson would come up with is here on page 4. Nobody has ever discovered a way of having real morals without a moral absolute. If there's no moral absolute, we are left with hedonism, doing what I like, or some form of social contract theory, what is best for society as a whole. However, neither of these alternatives corresponds to the moral notions that men have, nor to what men mean when they speak of morals. Without morals, without absolutes, morals as morals cease to exist. And humanistic man, starting from himself, has failed to find the absolute. But because the God of the Bible is there, real morals exist. Within this framework, I can say one action is right and another wrong, without talking nonsense. The first chapter, The Mere Christianity, by C.S. Lewis, is also excellent on this, as are his early chapters in Miracles. Lewis, in Miracles, page 37, talks about the meaning of the word ought. And whenever we say we ought to do something, it suggests that we have a moral standard. If the oughts of Mr. Wells and, say, Franco are both equally the impulses which nature has conditioned each to have, and both tell us nothing about any objective right or wrong, whence all the fervour? Do they remember while they are writing us that they... Do they remember while they are writing that when they tell us we ought to make a better world, the words ought and better must on their own showing refer to an irrationally conditioned impulse, which cannot be true or false any more than a vomit or a yawn? The ought or right or wrong have no more meaning, Lewis points out here, than a vomit or a yawn. My idea is that sometimes they do forget. That is their glory. Holding a philosophy which excludes humanity, they yet remain human, because they're made in the image of God. Then there's meaning here. Morality and meaning are the key factors. A very interesting confession by Aldous Huxley. I had motives for not wanting the world to have a meaning, consequently assumed it had none, and was able without any difficulty to find satisfying reasons for this assumption. The philosopher who finds no meaning in the world is not concerned exclusively with a problem in mere metaphysics. He's also concerned to prove there is no valid reason why he personally should not do as he wants to do, or why his friends should not seize political power and govern in the way they find most advantageous. For myself, the philosophy of meaninglessness was essentially an instrument of liberation, sexual and political. Or over page to page 5 by Camus. Up till now, man derived his coherence from his creator, but from the moment he consecrates his rupture with him, he finds himself delivered over to the fleeting moment, to the passing days, and to wasted sensibility. The central neurosis of our time is meaninglessness, and we can direct our approach often very fruitfully to the God-given and permanent quest for meaning that is there in the heart and life of every person. We'll have to stop at this point. Let me give you some... Probably most of us don't have the interest or the opportunity to read source books, and therefore mostly we were interested in reading the conclusions of other people. And here are some good books that will help us deal with thinking people. I've got them divided into three categories of priority in my own thinking. The first one is Runaway World by Michael Green. And one thing that you can do, and I've done it with this book a couple of times, several times in fact, is you don't have to have all the answers. And I remember in evangelism, this was one of the things I did with Greg Serple back in Southampton. I got him a copy of it, and he'd read a chapter, then I'd read a chapter, and we'd discuss it. And we did that once a week. And the first chapter deals with the evidence of history for Christianity. The second chapter deals with the evidence of philosophy and science, and so on through three or four chapters. And it's very readable, written for the non-Christian. And it's a good evangelistic tool. Another one, Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis, can be used in the same way, either for your own thinking or with a non-Christian. Probably Runaway World is best for a non-Christian. Here's another good one to read through with a non-Christian by Michael Green again, Man Alive. You have to read it through with them, otherwise it's rather a waste of time, and discuss it with them and highlight significant chapters. Now, one other one here by Clark Pinnock, published by Moody, is Set Forth Your Case. And this is a book that deals with the things we've been talking about this morning. It's much more readable, I found, than many of Schaefer's books. Set Forth Your Case by Clark Pinnock. And if you read that, and it's, at least as I read it, it seemed a much easier book to read than Schaefer's. He seemed to include most of what Schaefer has to say within the confines of about 200 pages. Excellent. Then over here, this would be second priority, is Miracles by C.S. Lewis. The reason why it's second priority is because in Mere Christianity you get a lot of Lewis's basic thinking, and Miracles just develops in greater detail some of the things he's only touched on in Mere Christianity. But Miracles is a great book on morality and on reason, and therefore is one you should read. Another one, a slightly different nature, is Christianity, the Evidence of History. And the reason why it's in the second column is that Runaway World, the first chapter of Runaway World, deals with most of the issues that are raised in that. Only again, this one deals with them more fully. That's by Professor J.N.D. Anderson. And I believe it's published by Tyndale. Michael Green, the same author as Runaway World. They're very complementary books. This one, Set Forth Your Case by Clark Pinnock, is a book that should be a lot better known, because it deals with so many of these issues in such a readable way. Many people find them more readable and more easy to understand than Schaefer. Then I'd also put down here The God Who Is There by Schaefer. And again, The God Who Is There seems to include most of what Schaefer has to say in his other books. And therefore, as third priority, I'd put the other Schaefer books. I've read, I think, just about all of them, and they're excellent. And I'm sure that each of you have books you could add to that. The ones that you can use in evangelism with a non-Christian, effectively, I would make Runaway World, number one, if we're talking of the thinking person who has good questions. Man Alive, maybe number two. Mere Christianity, number three. Set forth your cases for you rather than for the non-Christian. Once we become Christians, we're involved in a learning process to the end of our lives. Most people stop learning when they leave school. For us, that's the point where we begin. And God wants us to be men and women who can present the gospel rationally and simply in such a way that our contemporaries can understand and respond with saving faith in Jesus Christ.